From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, misconduct will be punished. President Obama addresses the veterans' care scandal but stops short of firing the head of the department involved.
If these allegations prove to be true, it is dishonourable, it is disgraceful, and I will not tolerate it, period.
Also today, why the International Space Station's future could be at the mercy of the Ukrainian crisis. And we hear from our correspondent in Nigeria as the country suffers a devastating series of terrorist attacks.
Very, very evident that Boko Haram has increased its impact and also its onslaught in northern Nigeria. And that's obviously everything aimed with a view to the Nigerian elections in February next year.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The U.S. is sending 80 American soldiers to Chad to help in the search for the missing Nigerian schoolgirls. Islamist militant group Boko Haram kidnapped more than 200 girls over a month ago and is threatening to sell them into slavery. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
U.S. President Barack Obama is stepping up America's commitment to the safe return of more than 200 kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls by sending some 80 troops to Chad. The decision was announced in a formal letter to the U.S. Congress, as required under the War Powers Act. Their orders are to help with reconnaissance, surveillance, and intelligence gathering. The soldiers will come home when their support in resolving the kidnapping situation is no longer required. The U.S. has denounced the multiple bombings by Boko Haram, saying these vicious attacks on defenseless Nigerian civilians and girls are unconscionable terrorist acts.
The move comes after dozens of people were left dead in Nigeria just 24 hours after a twin bomb attack left 118 dead. Boko Haram are thought to be behind the bloodshed. FSN's Gary Alfonso is in Nigeria and says the Islamist extremists are making their presence felt more than ever.
Very, very evident that Boko Haram has increased its impact and also its onslaught in northern Nigeria. And that's obviously everything aimed with a view to the Nigerian elections in February next year.
Officials in Washington have brushed off a $400 billion energy deal between Russia and China as Russian President Vladimir Putin wraps up a two-day visit to Shanghai. The deal has been dubbed a political victory for Mr. Putin, who is increasingly looking east, while the U.S. and Europe try to isolate Moscow over its annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki says an energy deal between Russia and China had been in the pipeline for at least a decade.
Energy is a global market, and there are negotiations about deals happening all over the world, especially between major consumers and major producers.
The U.S. firm eBay is forcing its users to change their passwords because its database was hacked 2 months ago. The California-based online giant says it has no evidence its customer accounts were attacked, but that a change of passwords will help to protect its members. Nina Maria Potts has more.
It was a cyber attack in late February and early March that compromised eBay's database, prompting the company to force its members now to change their passwords. The online giant has 128 million active users and generated some $212 billion worth of business in 2013 alone. eBay's corporate site says it only discovered 2 weeks ago that cyber attackers hacked a small number of employee login credentials, which gave them access to the company's systems.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. In Washington, President Barack Obama rejected calls from veterans advocacy groups to fire the head of the agency behind a health care scandal involving preventable deaths. The American president told reporters that he will instead order a thorough investigation into allegations of illegal behavior at the Department of Veterans Affairs.
When I hear allegations of misconduct, any misconduct, whether it's allegations of VA staff covering up long wait times or cooking the books, I will not stand for it.
Just 22 days ahead of the World Cup, Brazilian police forces are on a 24-hour strike held in 14 states throughout the country. Andrea Arenas reports.
Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo are among the striking cities, both places where World Cup host stadiums are located. Police are demanding a pay raise of up to 80%, and they are not the only ones with grievances. Military police and federal police say they also need a raise, but they are not planning to strike until the World Cup is over.
The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation has said it may relax its strict rules against drug taking in a bid to recruit more computer hackers. The organization's director, James Comey, said the FBI wants to build up its cybercrime unit and needs to fill 2,000 new jobs this year, but said finding young recruits has been a problem. And at least 70 people, including a police chief, a rabbi, and a Boy Scout leader, have been arrested on charges of trading child pornography in New York. After a five-week investigation, officials say it's one of the largest roundups ever in the New York City area. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Rejecting calls to fire the head of the agency behind a healthcare scandal involving preventable deaths, President Barack Obama today told reporters that he will instead order a thorough investigation into allegations of illegal behavior at the Department of Veterans Affairs. Our Washington correspondent, Alice Olstein, reports.
Reports recently surfaced from whistleblowers and inspectors general that some U.S. veterans' hospitals in Arizona, Colorado, and other states have been failing to treat patients in time, in some cases leading to their deaths. Worse, they tried to cover up rather than address the problem. President Obama spoke publicly about the issue for the first time on Wednesday, saying he needs more proof and more time before taking action.
I know the people are angry and want swift reckoning. I sympathize with that. But we have to let the investigators do their job and get to the bottom of what happened. Our veterans deserve to know the facts. Their families deserve to know the facts. Once we know the facts, I assure you, if there is misconduct, it will be punished.
One of the investigations he's ordered will be unveiled next week about reports of preventable veteran deaths, and another will be released in a month focusing on how to make structural improvements at the agency. White House spokesperson Jay Carney said many of the factors at issue in this scandal are nothing new.
Problems in the VA with access to health benefits has been with us as a country for a long time and has been exacerbated by the fact that we are at the back end of a more than decade-long period of war, where we've seen a significant increase in our veterans, in the number of veterans, and in the number of veterans who need disability benefits and health services. And that has been a challenge for the VA for a long, long time, certainly for the past decade or more.
Many veterans groups have been calling for the resignation of Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki for failing to adequately address this problem and had expected President Obama to announce his ouster Wednesday. But the president instead voiced support for Shinseki, himself an injured Vietnam War veteran with two Purple Hearts, and said he's confident in his sincere efforts to improve veteran health care and reduce veteran homelessness. But allegations of mismanagement and intentional wrongdoing continue to surface. The Project on Government Oversight has partnered with veteran advocacy groups to launch a website that allows workers at VA hospitals around the country to anonymously blow the whistle and report problems.
To put it in context, the VA has 230,000 estimated patient visits a day. So it's a huge system.
That's Adam Zagorin with the Project on Government Oversight. He says their website got more than 450 reports in just a few days, with more continuing to pour in, highlighting both specific and systemic issues.
Managers within the VA system are rewarded for reducing these delays, so it's creating incentives. People could be, under those circumstances, trying to game the system. I mean, if I pay you a lot more, if you get a certain outcome, you would think that would be a good thing. But if you can't achieve that outcome and you want to get the reward anyway, then that's when you get people who may be changing the numbers on the performance in their hospital.
A report from the VA Office of the Medical Inspector confirmed some of these findings, pointing to a clinic in Colorado that falsified appointment records to give the impression that staff doctors were meeting the agency's goal of seeing veteran patients within 14 days. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. Dozens of people have been killed in Nigeria just days after a double bombing in the country left over 100 dead. The attacks are believed to be the work of extremists Boko Haram, who came to international attention last month after the Islamist group kidnapped hundreds of Nigerian schoolgirls. US experts are currently assisting the ongoing search effort for the girls. FSN's Gary Alfonso is in Nigeria and spoke to me earlier.
Absolutely. I think the Nigerian authorities have their hands full with an obvious full onslaught from Boko Haram in the northeastern part of Nigeria, where this latest attack in Jos might be highlighted with all the Western media already in Nigeria at the moment. The issue is that these attacks have been carrying on almost on a daily basis, and with these kind of attacks, the bomb attack in Abuja probably about 4 weeks ago with the World Economic Forum, and now these two in Jos, obviously looks very, very evident that Boko Haram has increased its impact and also its onslaught in northern Nigeria, and that's obviously everything aimed with a view to the Nigerian elections in February next year.
What does this latest attack, this devastating spree of bombings, tell us about the capability of Boko Haram and how they're now operating in Nigeria?
Most of their attacks have been aimed at transport areas, bus terminals, mostly from the sort of centre of Nigeria to up towards the northeast, where obviously Chibok, where they kidnapped the girls, and where most of their attacks have been targeted. From what it looks like, and security officials have confirmed this, it certainly looks like the attacks, and particularly the explosives and planting explosives at very busy markets or at transport terminals, is not something that Boko Haram is very well known for, but it's certainly something they've started doing of late. And obviously the fears are that if these attacks move south towards the more populous areas like Lagos or Port Harcourt, where the oil companies are situated, then that would be certainly a game changer.
And you mentioned that the international eye is trained on Nigeria because of that mass abduction in Chibok a month ago. Can you give us a status update on the operation to find these girls?
Well, there's lots of frustration here in Nigeria about the seeming snail's pace of trying to find the more than 200 girls. The exact number, even to this day, is not really known. Many people figure it to be way over 300, because there have been lots of small little kidnapping incidents even since that time. And Chibok, which is about 100 miles north of where I am right now, is just one of the areas where girls have been snatched over the past 12 months. Now, the American support crews have visited the area, military experts and also Israeli experts, particularly air surveillance teams have visited the area, but there hasn't been much feedback, for one, from the authorities, and secondly, obvious frustration expressed by lots of local communities. A very, very dense area, very, very dense forested area, so not an easy task, but certainly it seems like there's not much communication about what the teams are doing to try and get those girls back.
Gary Alfonso in Nigeria. Now, the White House has announced that Prime Minister of New Zealand, John Key, will visit Washington for talks with President Obama next month. The two men are expected to discuss global trade negotiations, moves to combat climate change, and military-to-military cooperation. A White House spokesman said an increasingly close relationship had developed between the US and New Zealand governments. Both are members of the so-called Five Eyes group that sees them, along with Australia, Canada and Great Britain, share intelligence information with one another. However, in New Zealand, there's growing concern over that, with opposition politicians campaigning against any assistance the country may give in US drone strikes along the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Brent Edwards, political editor for Radio New Zealand, filed this report.
He has faced more questions about electronic spying on the day the White House announced he would be meeting President Obama next month. The United Future leader and government minister Peter Dunne says confirmation that information gathered by the GCSB could have been used to help American drone attacks gives added impetus to calls for a public debate on the spy agency's work.
The issue really comes down to wider use and what information that may be sourced from New Zealand is being used for what purposes. And I think we need to have some sort of public discussion about what New Zealanders as a whole think is acceptable in that regard.
The Green Party co-leader Russell Norman is appalled by New Zealand's involvement in drone attacks.
I think most New Zealanders would be appalled with the idea that effectively they and we and all of us now are implicated in the US extrajudicial killings via drone strikes.
But Mr. Key has no worries about New Zealand's role.
For someone to be subject, for instance, under the ISAF rules in Afghanistan, to be on a particular list that could see them subjected to a drone strike, it has to be, you know, very relevant. It has to be in a 6-week period or less. They have to be absolutely confident of the information, you know, all of those sorts of things. So, you know, you are talking about a different kind of environment. You know, President Obama's used drones. That's a matter for them, really. You know, I think under the circumstances in which I can see that they've been used, for the most part, I'm comfortable with it.
Peter Dunne doesn't share the Prime Minister's confidence.
I'm not comfortable with the apparent indiscriminate nature, the randomness of it, and the fact that there have been a number of mistakes. But New Zealand doesn't operate any drones, and it's not really for us to offer a view about the operability. What I think we've got to be concerned about is that the information that New Zealand is sourcing is not being misused by those who are having access to it.
Mr. Key says publicity about the sharing of information is nothing new. He says people have known for a long time that this country shares intelligence with the US, Britain, Canada and Australia as part of the Five Eyes arrangement.
It makes sense for New Zealand to be able to share information with partners that have a lot more access to that information for the safety and security of our people. But lots of countries share. We share information with all sorts of other peoples.
John Key says he does not expect to raise the matter when he meets President Obama on Friday, June the 20th. But the Labour Party leader David Cunliffe says the question of mass surveillance and drone attacks should be on the agenda for the two leaders.
Brent Edwards, the political editor of Radio New Zealand, reporting from the country's parliament. Now, around 400 million people in Europe will head to the polls to vote in the European elections from Thursday, with the results due on Sunday night. In the United Kingdom, the debate about the country's involvement in Europe and immigration are dominating the agenda. Political parties are split between Britain staying in Europe or leaving. FSN's Daniel Whitehead has the story.
Just yards away from power in Westminster, pubgoers here at the Westminster Arms are mulling over the big issues ahead of this year's European elections. It doesn't usually get much attention, but this time round, voters can't escape the battle over Britain's relationship with Europe. As they sip on their pints, the issue of whether or not the UK should stay part of the EU is filling newspapers and TV screens across Britain. British candidates for the European Parliament are fighting this election at an all-time high for Euroscepticism, partly fuelled by Nigel Farage, the leader of the UK Independence Party.
The European dream is crumbling, absolutely crumbling.
Ian Dunt, the editor of politics.co.uk, says disillusion like this with Europe is the message driving this election.
Overwhelmingly this time around, it's Europe itself and immigration. And that takes the form really of a policy agenda that's been put forward by UKIP, United Kingdom Independence Party, which is putting forward a very quite hard right, very tough, extremely Eurosceptic anti-immigration message.
And it's immigration that's the key issue. Free movement laws mean people within the European Economic Area are welcome to come and live and work in Britain without the tougher checks faced by those from outside Europe. When the newly joined EU countries Bulgaria and Romania had their visa restrictions lifted this January, far-right parties warned about the huge influx of immigrants from those countries heading to Britain to work. In fact, the number fell. Opponents say that scuppers UKIP's scaremongering tactics about immigration numbers. But one of UKIP's MEP candidates and the culture spokesman for the party, Peter Whittle, disagrees.
You know, people aren't all going to suddenly come on January the 1st, as it were. It will take much longer than that. But we are seeing more and more people coming. And of course, there will be further countries added to the EU. What that really means with Turkey or Albania, Moldova and these countries, is that there will be 400 so million people who will have the right to come here.
So while UKIP wants out of Europe to protect Britain's borders and to bring back power to Westminster, the Liberal Democrats' party message couldn't be more different. They want to stay in the EU. Candidate Jonathan Fryer says immigration brings huge benefits to Britain.
I think we have to be honest and admit that Britain, and particularly London, has done very well out of immigration. Both migration of EU workers who have the right to come, just as Brits have gone to work on the continent, and immigration from further afield.
So what about the two main parties? Well, the Prime Minister and the leader of the Conservatives, David Cameron, wants a reformed relationship between Britain and the EU. Speaking to the BBC, he admits the free movement of people across European countries can't be changed, but has promised a referendum if his party wins the next general election.
We will hold that referendum by the end of 2017. It will be a referendum on an in-out basis. Do we stay in a reformed European Union or do we leave? And I've said very clearly that whatever the outcome of the next election, and of course I want an overall majority and I'm hoping and believing I can win an overall majority, but people should be in no doubt. I will not become Prime Minister unless I can guarantee that we will hold that referendum.
Well,
meanwhile, the Labour Party has taken a step back from the battle about staying in or out of Europe. Leader Ed Miliband says Labour wants to stop powers transferring to Brussels, but admits it's unlikely the party will hold an in-out referendum. In a BBC interview, he said the party will instead focus on what Labour calls the cost of living crisis.
The direction of travel we want for Europe is not with an ever closer union, but actually some powers coming back. So we've made that clear. But it's true to say that when I think about the priorities for me as Prime Minister, it's about the cost of living crisis, the NHS, not debating whether we should exit the European Union.
There are many other parties fighting in this European election, but back at the Westminster Arms, there remains frustration and confusion. Many say they know the benefits of immigration, but feel more controls are needed.
Well, we're only a small island, and of course, there's only so much room. How do you control it? But if we're part of Europe, you know, the European element that has to apply.
I think it's an absolutely brilliant thing. I mean, if you think about the way that the UK is as a country, as a culture, then it embraces, or always has done, embraced other people's cultures.
We are getting inundated, so it's just too much, isn't it? You know, the jobs, the working, the unemployment, housing.
The European elections are a way for the parties in the UK to get a taste of how they're doing ahead of the general election next year. But more than ever before, this round of voting is touching on subjects that are really important to British voters. The results will provide a clear snapshot of the UK's future in Europe, whether that's in or out. Dan Whitehead, London.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, the segment of the show that takes an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the out-of-this-world impact of the standoff between the US and Russia over Ukraine. NASA's administrator said this week that geopolitical tensions between Washington and Moscow won't spell the end for the International Space Station. But Russia is warning that it could stop cooperating with the US on the project after the year 2020. The two countries have spent more than $150 billion on the space station since the project's inception in 1990. Ian Steadman is the science and technology correspondent for Britain's New Statesman, and he spoke to the magazine's deputy editor, Helen Lewis.
It's become a geopolitical bargaining chip between the US and Russia, which is something that, as the Ukraine crisis was sort of kicking off a couple months ago, some people said, oh, this is a bit awkward because there are currently three Russians and two Americans on the International Space Station.
And one Japanese guy.
And one Japanese guy.
He's really, like, staying well out of it.
The first Japanese mission commander on the ISS. What was overshadowed that was the fact that, well, for many years, since the fall of the Soviet Union, the ISS has kind of acted as this thing in the sky that represents international cooperation between nation states. And it's sort of the peaceful exploration of the stars, and we do experiments in space and all kinds of stuff. And it's kind of like, you know, an international neutral
thing. This makes me a
thing.
Bit sad because I now think of all those scientists at CERN from the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah.
Like the American scientists sitting at one table at lunch and now like the Russian scientists at another table
yeah.
at lunch. And I'm sure that isn't true.
Like, like a high school movie.
I have no evidence that CERN is a mean girls. But you know, but both of those, both CERN and both the ISS, were these great symbols of international cooperation.
Yeah.
So what's happened now?
Well, originally NASA said to everyone, like, don't worry, everything's going to be fine. At the moment, NASA doesn't have its own spaceships, but the space shuttle was retired in 2011. So the Russian Soyuz rockets, as featured in the film Gravity as well, are the main spacecraft that are used to get people up the,
which is the scene of a really sad anecdote in Chris Hadfield's book, actually, because at a stroke when they announced that, there were a whole load of American astronauts who were too tall to go in Soyuz because it's smaller than the shuttle.
It's an old piece of kit, really, and NASA is developing its own things, but they're going to be ready for a few years.
There's been a lot of cooperation until now. There's
absolutely. I mean,
American astronauts going to the amazingly named Star City.
Yes.
And speaking fluent Russian and Russian and American both being English.
Other nations as well, like the European Space Agency, the Indian Space Agency, lots of other agencies cooperate on the ISS. But what Russia said is that it will not be extending the contracts, not extending the lifespan of the ISS beyond 2020. Originally, it was only meant to finish in 2016, so it's already got four more years than it was expected to get. But the Americans were convinced that it could last till 2024, because it's, by some measures, like the most expensive thing that's ever been built, $70-something billion on this one object. So it's kind of, you want to get your money's worth, as it were. But the Russians have kind of said, no, we're going to take our ball and go home and not play with you. And even worse, what they're going to do is the ISS originally began as a Russian space station that was being planned at the end of the Cold War. The USSR collapsed. They used the basis of that space station to form the ISS. So the core modules that contain stuff like life support and all that, they can detach from the ISS. They're Russian. They can live on their own and act as their own independent space station. But the other stuff, all the like American modules and the USA modules and like the ARM, which is built by Canada and stuff, they can't. They will just like fall into the atmosphere and burn up. So Russia said that they're going to detach their modules and make their own new space station.
That's amazing. It's our module and we'll do what we like.
Exactly. And to be fair, like the thing that they want to build is called OPSEC, and it's effectively going to be a spacecraft workshop in space. So the Russians want to go explore Mars or land on the moon. So they're going to build a new space station called OPSEC that will be where they fly parts up to it. They build the spaceships there. They like fly crews up to it. The crews get on the spaceship there and stuff because it's easier and cheaper than doing it all from the ground. But still, it kind of sucks for the ISS because the ISS is just left. It was this thing that kind of brought everyone together, and it kind of felt like, okay, space exploration can be. It's not.
It was
gonna
very
be...
Star Trek, wasn't it? It was like, let's look forward to the future in which national boundaries are meaningless, and we all work together for the betterment of humanity.
It's all got kind of echoes of the original space race in the Cold War, and okay, we got a lot of cool technology out of that, but cooperation is a bit nicer than making it just another thing. Like, it'd be nice if we landed on the moon together, for instance, but no, it'll be a bunch of countries being selfish again.
Ian Steadman of The New Statesman talking to the magazine's deputy editor, Helen Lewis. And if you want to try and see the International Space Station, you can go to spotthestation.com and sign up for email alerts that will tell you when to look up at the sky. That's spotthestation.com. And there's much more from The New Statesman on their website, newstatesman.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Thursday, we look at the rise of the far-right parties tipped to make a big footprint in this week's European elections. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.